This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Expanding access to preschool and early learning has been a priority for educators and policymakers recently, and with good reason. Research has shown that the earlier students are exposed to a group learning experience, the better they do later on in their education. Now the federal government is offering states money to help step up their game.
Evidence has shown over and over again that there are lifetime benefits from early learning programs.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about a new Race to the Top-like competition among states for early learning grants. We'll also spend an academic minute hearing about videos that claim to do the same thing for your child, give them a head start on learning. You know, the ones that sound too good to be true. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge.
The Preschool for All plan would help all states keep their promises to our children and ensure that more than a million additional kids, regardless of zip code or family background or income, are ready to succeed in school and beyond.
That's U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan talking about the Obama administration's Preschool for All initiative, which the president talked about during his State of the Union address this year.
Tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America. That's something we should be able to do.
Now, the U.S. Department of Education has announced the launch of a new $250 million preschool development grants competition that will help states build, expand, and improve high-quality preschool programs for children from low- and moderate-income families. Here to talk about this new competition is Chris Perry, the executive director of the First 5 Years Fund, a nonprofit that advocates for early childhood education. We talked about Secretary Duncan's announcement.
The secretary announced the preschool development grant program that now states can apply for matching grants to extend services for children in their state who are not yet in an early learning program or if they'd like to improve the quality of that program.
I did notice that there are two different types of grants, the development and the expansion grants. Do you feel it's important to include both of those?
I do. In fact, I think it's really indicative of where we are in America today with early learning programs. States have really done a great job of meeting the needs of children that want to go to preschool, and other states haven't had that as a priority and need that development grant money to get started. And a state like Florida, with so many kids in the program already, would probably benefit from funds to help them analyze, evaluate, and improve the program.
Let's look at the country overall. Is there any like geographic area that's better off than the others?
You can't really say anything in terms of regions. It's very individual based on states. And even within states, there can be big differences. If you think about Texas or California or New York, where the population is so large, it can be very different from upstate versus downstate. And we've learned over the years that there are neighborhoods and communities that are more affluent and have more resources and more kids are able to go to preschool because their parents can afford it. And then there are neighborhoods where kids who really need those services and benefit very much from them, their parents don't have the resources for them to go. And at one point, when they turn 5 or 6 years old, all those kids end up in the public school system together for kindergarten and beyond. And so it really behooves us, and Arne Duncan understands this, to get all the kids ready for kindergarten no matter where they live.
I looked at the announcement, and it said that states and communities are eligible to apply for these grants. So can individual communities within different states go for it?
I think that's a possibility. What you would have instead of the state superintendent, you might have a county superintendent or a regional group of school districts come together and apply together as a large consortium. The preference is for states to look first at the application and potentially apply as a state so that they can distribute those resources to individual districts or communities based on need or readiness. But in the event that a state superintendent for some reason isn't interested or a governor isn't interested, there's still an option for others to apply so that it's not dependent on one person.
Let's talk about who's been doing things right. Which states really have great programs in place already?
Well, I want to start with Florida. I think that, as I said, there's a tremendous amount of access in Florida. More than 80% of 4-year-olds are able to go to an early learning program for at least half the day. And along with Florida, states like Oklahoma, California, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Nebraska, Illinois have all been working really hard for the past 10 to 15 years to increase state spending on early learning so that they can get that percentage up close to where Florida is. Some states are hovering at 50%. Here, Florida's, you know, in the upper 80s. That is a big achievement, and other states want that kind of uptake as well.
We talked about the states who are doing a good job. How about some states that need some help or need to get started? See, for the development grants, it says there are 16 states eligible for that. Does that mean there are 16 states that aren't doing much of anything?
Well, they've had, yeah, that's true. There are 16 states that the Department of Education has identified as still sort of not meeting a majority of the children's needs. In other words, they don't have state-level services available. So they're anxious to lend this extra support to get them up and running and more like Florida and California and New York because they know what the evidence says about early learning. It doesn't mean the will isn't there or even the finances aren't there. This is still a relatively new idea that children under the age of five benefit from an early learning program. And we don't mean, you know, it mimics kindergarten or first grade. It's very specific to their age, and a three-year-old has a different set of needs than a four-year-old, and states really do have to take the time to understand what those needs are and build up towards meeting those needs. Facilities are different. The teachers are different. What the parents need is different. So you have to plan quite extensively to prepare for that.
And talk about the importance of early education, of early learning. How does that create a foundation for a child?
Evidence has shown over and over again that there are lifetime benefits from early learning programs. We've seen studies now that have followed Head Start students until into their 50s and evaluated how they're doing financially, how their health is, and frankly just how they're doing emotionally. And they do better than children of the same age who didn't attend a high-quality early learning program. There are those lifetime benefits, but there are also very immediate benefits to children who go even for 1 year, they do better when they start kindergarten on very observable things such as knowing their numbers and letters, but even more importantly, understanding how to be in a group, how to be with another adult, how to be with other children, how to manage themselves, but also how to learn from someone other than their parents. I think those skills take several months to acquire, and children who go even 1 year before, much less 2, 3, or 4 years before, do better.
That's interesting you bring that part of it up, the social aspect. You think of the old time, you know, some kid's first day in kindergarten screaming, I want my parents back. That's something that this is working against.
Well, you know, there even a child who's been to preschool is probably going to experience some separation anxiety on the first day of kindergarten. It's a big developmental step. And I think most of your listeners and even you and I can remember that day pretty well. It's a major step forward in your growing up. But if you've been to preschool and you've had that experience of leaving your parents and going with a teacher or going with your friends for the day, it's definitely less stressful. And you're probably even really enjoying it. In other words, it's a highlight of your day. It's what you look forward to. You're happy to say goodbye to your parents after a couple of days and play with your friends and see your teacher. That's what we hope the quality programs will always provide for kids.
And what about the grants themselves? Is this a competition, something like the Race to the Top was?
Yeah, it's kind of a good comparison, actually. Those Race to the Top dollars were for a point in time. They were made available to states. They were intended to encourage higher quality services that met certain requirements or criteria, but the state was really given a lot of room to decide what was best for their state. And we know how different a southern state and a northern state or a rural state versus one with more urban areas, their needs really do need to be decided upon by the leaders of the state versus the Department of Education, Washington, D.C., dictating what every state should have, how much of it, you know, when it starts, when it ends. I think it's good to put those benchmarks in place, but the real details, I think, have to emerge from the leaders in that state.
And from what you understand about the grants, what types of programs are they looking for? What types of ideas do they want?
Well, they know what quality early learning is. They know what quality preschool is. And so they're going to be looking for applications that either describe what they already have and it meets those quality standards, or describes a process for figuring it out. So those development grants are more, in a sense, you might call them planning grants, and the expansion grants are really intended to make sure states are doing things at the level of quality that the department recommends and then rewards it, right, or provides an incentive for them to keep doing it with the expansion grant. Quality is really somewhat simple to understand. It's how well-trained the teacher is, how much of an education she's had, not only in general but around child development. It's how many children you put in a room with the teachers. You cannot have too many children for health and safety reasons, but also for attachment and learning. You also have to have a component that really addresses the parents' needs. You brought up that example of how sad and hard it is for both the parent and the child to say goodbye to each other. Many of these programs provide support to the parent as well to make sure that that is a positive experience.
Still to come, our conversation with Chris Perry, the executive director of the First 5 Years Fund, continues with a look at just what the First 5 Years Fund is. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1249. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Chris Perry, the executive director of the First 5 Years Fund. We're talking about a new competition among the states announced by the U.S. Department of Education concentrating on preschool and early learning education grants. While we were talking, I asked Chris Perry about the mission of the First 5 Years Fund.
Well, we're a bipartisan advocacy organization that works really hard to increase federal investments in early learning programs in states. So the preschool development grant program is exactly the kind of thing we work to achieve because it provides extra help to states that are responsible for children birth to 18 and supports parents, particularly parents who are low income or have no job at all and can't afford these services. We all know a preschool program can run upwards of $10,000 a year, and a parent on minimum wage would be lucky to make $25,000 a year. So this is not affordable, but it is essential for the child's development. First 5 Years Fund also looks at the national landscape and tries to understand what it is parents really want, and we've been polling them and finding out that regardless of party affiliation, age, race, gender, geography, there is virtually universal support for a bigger investment in early learning, and we really carry that message to Congress and to the White House to encourage them to do more.
Well, taking a look at some of these, proposals will be, are you expecting a lot of innovation, or are you expecting people to try to reinvent the wheel? It looks like people know what good early education is.
I like that word, innovation. There is a lot of excitement around early learning because it's an opportunity in some ways to start fresh. Most people have feelings about the K-12 system, good or bad. They see the system as in some ways older and more entrenched. This opportunity with early learning really does allow for innovation and creativity. And there are a number of experts who know quite well how to train teachers, what specifically it is that they can do to help children learn more quickly and more effectively. And some of those ideas can even be delivered through new technology. It doesn't always require a teacher sitting in a classroom herself at night to get college units. Sometimes these things can be done through virtual services, through a mentor teacher who travels through a neighborhood, ways of sharing resources and using technology and online support are emerging as really good tools for scaling up the workforce more effectively and actually more cheaply.
So I guess we just have to learn how to better use those tools now, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. One thing I would just love to share is the urgency of this situation. The Department of Education is releasing $250 million, which is wonderful. But to put it in perspective, the Head Start program that has been in place for almost 50 years has an $8 billion a year budget, and it is only meeting the needs of half the eligible children in America who would like or benefit from being in that program. In other words, we would need to double that amount to meet the needs of children. $250 million, $8 billion, $16 billion. As you know, the federal budget contains many, many things in it. For example, next year they're thinking of purchasing some new helicopters for the military, and that alone would be $3 billion. They think we have a reprioritization to make. Early learning, I hope, rises more to the top as Congress looks at the future budget, and it looks at our future period, and it sees that kids, no matter what their economic background, benefit greatly from early learning and need some extra help.
Are you finding that that this really is a bipartisan issue, that there really isn't much resistance to it?
It's so exciting to see that, because many issues get politicized, and one side or the other wants it or doesn't want it. Early learning is really supported by both parties' voters, and I hope more and more our elected officials embrace it as well, no matter what side of the issue they're on. I think it's gotten to a point where we're not really talking about whether or not to do more early learning, but how will we pay for it? And that's progress, and that's where a lot of issues end up. How much can we afford? And hopefully parents and other people will make their voices heard if they feel that it helps their children, their grandchildren, the kids in their neighborhood do better and help the economy and the society overall to have that opportunity.
Yeah, it would be interesting to hear what the argument against it would be.
Yes, it tends to be, there tend to be two arguments. Number one, I mentioned already, is there is a cost associated with this. But then there is still an idea that some people have that children will do better at home, that if they were with a parent throughout the day, that they would do better. And what we like to say is parents are their children's first teacher and play a critical role. But an early learning program is really an enhancement, and it really adds to the child's readiness for school and life and is not a takeaway. It's really additive. And I think especially now with more than two-thirds of women working outside the home and maybe even holding down more than one job, this becomes also part of how we keep the economy going and keep parents at work.
Chris Perry is the executive director of the First 5 Years Fund. You can learn more about the fund at ffyf.org. In Ohio, the changeover to Common Core standards is changing the way young students study English, spending less time with storybooks and more time with nonfiction texts. From State Impact Ohio, Molly Bloom reports.
Teacher Karen Hazlett's fourth graders spent much of their English class this fall learning about child labor.
And then we've already read, what is child labor? What I want to do now is
Hazlett teaches in Akron's Miller South School for the Visual and Performing Arts. This is her 34th year in the classroom. And until recently, child labor probably would not be a central topic in her fourth grade English classes. Hazlett's students would read mostly fiction and answer questions about their opinions on plot and characters. Hazlett says one of the biggest changes with the new Common Core English standards is a greater emphasis on nonfiction material.
It used to be like maybe 20 to 30% of our teaching was nonfiction, and now it's 50 or more. That's a huge difference.
The new standards are tougher than Ohio's old standards, and they require students to analyze writing more deeply. She has the Common Core standards for today's lesson posted on her chalkboard.
Okay, here they are. Okay. So integrate information from two topics, explain the reasons using evidence, looking for details, drawing inference, drawing conclusions, main idea.
Hazlett's students have already read a series of articles about child labor written at maybe a 6th or 7th grade level. That's higher than what they would have encountered a few years ago. Today, she has them work together in pairs to draw some conclusions from what they've read. As she talks to her students, the phrase you hear over and over again is cite evidence.
Where in the text did you get that idea? Read it with me.
What is one important new thing you have learned from reading these texts? Cite evidence.
Pairs of students pour over the photocopied articles.
Well, it says Asia, Africa, and Latin America do it a lot.
It says it can be mentally, physically, socially, or morally dangerous and harmful to children and interferes with schooling.
Teaching these young kids to work with factual evidence is a big change, Hazlett says.
And I've been teaching a long time, and I was like, why didn't we think of that before? Because it helps them to go back and focus on the text.
Other English classes in Akron are studying topics like CSI-style forensic anthropology, space exploration, and food safety. The lessons are part of Common Core aligned units developed by the University of Pittsburgh. Akron teacher Anna Panning's fifth graders are learning about space exploration.
It's really rigorous, and I sort of have them pumped up with, you know, this is going to be tough, but we can do it. And, you know, so they're really enjoying the work so far. They're really enjoying this work, and they love the topic. They love the topic. So,
English curriculum supervisor Tuan Dang Nguyen began introducing the Common Core to Akron teachers 3 years ago. Since then, Akron has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on things like new materials and substitutes so teachers can attend Common Core training.
It's here are the standards, here's a model unit, here's some training to see what you can do with those standards. So we're not, you know, just sending them off and saying good luck.
She says the long phase-in may mean fewer surprises for her teachers and students when the new Common Core aligned tests start next spring. For State Impact Ohio, I'm Molly Bloom.
And while we're speaking about giving your kids a good head start in life, you know those videos being peddled that claim that can make your child a genius just by watching? You know, the ones that sound too good to be true? Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. There's a big industry of educational media marketed to young children. But as Matt LaPierre, assistant professor of communications at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, suggests, the educational claims of these products may be nothing more than clever marketing.
Chances are, if you or someone close to you has had a child in the last decade, you are acquainted with baby videos. For those of you who are unfamiliar with them, they are often sold with brand names such as Baby Einstein or Baby IQ, with most recent estimates showing that two-thirds of American homes with young children own one. Yet there is little available evidence to suggest that children under 3 learn from these videos. Moreover, the makers of these videos have come under fire for the way that the videos are marketed, with their suggestive titles and vague product claims. For example, this video will inspire language learning. Working with my friend Sarah Valla, we wanted to test whether certain types of marketing cues affected the average American parent. In our experiment, we asked parents to evaluate a brand new video. We wanted to see if parents thought that the video would teach their child and if these parents would be interested in buying the video for their child. However, parents did not all see the same video cover. In one of our experimental conditions, one half of parents saw a video with the brand name Little Genius, while the other half saw a video named Little Munchkins. While there are no other differences, parents who saw the Little Genius box were more likely to say that their child would learn from watching the video. In addition, we tested the specificity of the marketing claims used with the product, as one half of parents saw a cover that said their child would learn versus another half who saw claims that the child would be inspired. In fact, we found that parents were not careful readers of product claims, as parents who saw the less explicit claim were just as likely to think the product was educational as those who saw the explicit claim. Since this is the first study to investigate the impact these marketing strategies have on parents, more research is necessary. However, our research does suggest that parents are eager to see educational gains for their children when the research so far has shown there are none.
That was Matt LaPierre of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.